And joining us on Perspectives today is Steve Gillen. Professor Gillen is a scholar in residence at the History Channel and a professor of history at the University of Oklahoma. He is one of nation's leading experts on modern American history. His articles have appeared in both academic journals and such newspapers as the LA Times, the New York Daily News, Chicago Tribune, and the Boston Globe. Steve, thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we are visiting with Steve because he is the author of the book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. And I'm sure that a lot of people out there are anxious to find out more about what you found out. But first of all, Steve, I was fascinated also by your upbringing in the book. You talk a little bit about the fact, and you had a job working for Scott. And that's not a law. And that's not a law firm.
I worked my way through college making toilet paper. Perhaps your listeners know my product. I worked. I made Cottonelle. I came from a working class family. My whole family worked at the toilet paper factory. Many of them still do. And I had a summer job there to raise money so I could pay my tuition to go to college. So what was interesting, I come from this working class Irish Catholic background, and here I'm meeting, John from a very different world. And John, one of the great things about John is he was so fascinated. He liked surrounding himself with people who were different from himself. He loved hearing stories about what it was like growing up in the neighborhood where I grew up, and what it was like to work in a factory. John had a great sense of adventure and also of curiosity. And there were other people in his life, very similar, who came from very different backgrounds. And John was very eclectic in the types of people he gathered around him.
Now, let me let our audience know that, first of all, when you met John Kennedy Jr., you were applying for graduate school program to pursue your PhD, and you were asked to prepare a lecture. And what you did is you prepared a lecture, but you had no idea that criticizing JFK's policies was the lecture, and that one of your students was John Kennedy Jr. Not only did he walk in late, but he sat in the front row.
That's right. So I had never spoken in public before, and I was actually in grad school working on my PhD, and I was a teaching assistant in a class, and the professor required us to give a lecture. And I, before students had enrolled in the class, I offered to give a lecture on the Kennedy administration. And then just my luck, John shows up as a student in the class. On that day that I gave the lecture, I'm actually petrified. I'm standing in front of the room, and my hands are shaking, my knees are banging against each other, and I look around, and at least John's not there, and it's like 10 minutes to the hour. And of course, the back door swings open, and John saunters in, and he sits 10 feet in front of me. So I'm giving a lecture about a guy's father, and his son is going to be in front of me. And it was a somewhat critical, I think it was a fair-minded lecture about his father, his strengths, his limitations. And afterwards, John came up and thanked me for giving the lecture.
A lot of people would say that being put in a situation, whether you're giving a speech, singing a song, or whatever, once you get that first line out, you're better. But your first line was something different.
Yeah, well, so I'm up there, and I'd written this lecture. I practiced it for probably 4 weeks. I mean, I knew this thing inside out, backwards, forward. I would repeat it 4 or 5 times a day. There's no way I was going to mess this up. So when I'm standing there, and the clock hits 11, and I go blank. I mean, I can't remember a thing. And, some people that have this, they reach down inside, and they find this inner strength that gets them through a difficult time. I'm not one of those people. I hyperventilate. And so I'm hyperventilating. I'm almost passing out. So my lecture began with, and I had to blurt something out. I knew I had to say something. I looked down at the lecture, and it was all blurry because I was almost about to pass out. So I blurted out, President Kennedy had no moral scruples. Now, I have to tell you, that's not the way I felt then. It's not certainly not the way I feel now. I have no idea where that came from, but it saved my career as a teacher because a student in the back of the room couldn't see the look of fear on my face, and she laughed. And the whole class erupted in laughter. They thought it was just a joke. And then once that broke the ice, I was able to go ahead and get the lecture. But my entire career, in 30-plus year career in teaching, I owe it all to that person in the back of the room who laughed.
We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Gillen. Stephen is the author of the book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. After that class, as you said, John Kennedy Jr. went up to you and thanked you, but then you went on to become pretty good friends.
That's right. So that was his sophomore year. I didn't see much of him. It was his junior year. And his senior year, we started working out together. We're both frustrated athletes, so we were lifting weights. And then John came up to me one time and he said, you know, I want to get some cardio and not just lift weights, and I want to play racquetball. So we found a place that had racquetball courts about 20-minute drive from Brown. And you know, once, twice a week during that senior year, his senior year, we'd get in his car, we'd go over and play these vicious games of racquetball. We'd lift weights, and then we'd go and have something to eat. And that was really the year that I got to know him and really bonded with him. And we stayed friends right up until the end. I spoke to him 2 days before he died.
You mentioned in your book that John Jr. was a very outgoing person, very friendly, but he appreciated people who saw him for who he was and not for who everybody expected him to be.
That's right. John used to tell me that he was two people. But he was just John, just a typical, though privileged, member of his generation. But he had a role to play, and that role was as John Fitzgerald Kennedy Jr., the son of the beloved slain president. And he understood, you know, I think that salute, that famous salute that we all remember on that day, November 25th, 1963, I think all the unfulfilled hopes and expectations of the Kennedy presidency transferred to John. And he understood that. He understood why people looked at him the way they did. They saw him as the person who was going to return the nation to Camelot, to an earlier time when America was hopeful and idealistic. So he understood that, but he never allowed that to bleed into his own identity. That was the great struggle of John's life, was to forge his own identity separate from the expectations that other people imposed upon him.
At what point, Steve, did you decide to write a book about him?
Just a couple years ago. So while John was alive, I, like many of his friends, protected his privacy. But I feel that as his friend, but also as an historian, I now have a responsibility to preserve his legacy. I don't want John to be remembered as the hunk flunks or the sexiest man alive. The John I knew was far more complicated. There are many different dimensions to his personality. And I want the Americans to know, I want the world to know who John, the John I really knew, and about John I knew, and not see him just as some Adonis who's plastered on the cover of popular magazines.
Now, because what you just mentioned, your title as a historian, as a professor, did that open up some doors for people to speak with you? I know that his cousin Anthony's wife spoke with you because of who you were.
Well, they trusted me. First of all, they knew I was friends with John, and they knew that we had a close relationship. But I think they also knew that I wrote, this is my 13th book, and I write pretty serious history books, and they knew that I would treat John seriously, and it would not be just another tabloid gossip book. And I think that's why many of them, including Carol and also Michael Berman, John's business partner who's been friend for 10 years, has never spoken about John. And I spent probably 20 hours with him. And there are others too. And even those who had spoken before told me things they had not shared. There's a lot of new, and I've never talked about John or my experiences with John. So there's a lot of new, fresh material that's in the book.
We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Gillen. Stephen is the author of the book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. In the book, a lot of people admired his mother, Jackie, because of what she did, you know, after that tragic day in Dallas and the single mom and taking care of these two young children. And she went on to be very, very protective of them and kind of the opposite of what Ethel Kennedy did with her children. And you write in your book that at one point, Jackie wasn't really a big fan of the Secret Service.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things I did, I sued the Secret Service to get access to documents related to John. And as part of the settlement, they turned over some 500 pages. And it shows two things. One is what a bubble John lived in for the first 16 years of his life. I mean, every time he went out, it had to be carefully scripted and who was going to cover him, who was going to protect him. So I get a sense of why John was so restless because he grew up in a bubble. But it's also this intense conflict between Jackie and the Secret Service. And she felt that they they were too close to John. She wanted John to have a normal life, a normal childhood. And this goes back and forth for years. And then finally, when John has his bike stolen in Central Park, I think it's 74, she writes this blistering letter to the Secret Service where she says, "If anything happens to John, I won't be as nice to you as I was after Dallas." That gives you an idea of just how sour that relationship had become. I also have the internal Secret Service documents about how to respond to her. And essentially, they said, "We just have to put up with it. We only have a couple more years. Let's just let it go."
And some of those agents have gone on to write books. I know Clint Hill wrote one, Me and Mrs. Kennedy.
That's right. Clint, well, I spoke extensively with Clint. Actually, when I got the documents, I sent them to Clint, and there's lots of markings on these documents, and he was able to talk me through what they meant. So he was a great resource for me.
Tell me a little bit about, you mentioned in the book that because people expected John Jr. to be a certain person, that he really took care of his body, he exercised, because that's one of the things he could control.
Absolutely right. I think that there's so much of John's life that was beyond his control. The one thing he could do was to control his body and his appearance. So John worked hard. I mean, I used to work out with him, and he's really intense, long workouts that he did. You know, he was working out probably 4 days a week and then doing all kinds of other activities. So those muscles and that physique was not genetic. That was something that John was responsible for, and he liked it. He liked other people to see it. So, you know, John had this relationship with the paparazzi that he didn't like. He said they invaded his privacy, but if he wasn't in the news for a couple of days, you can bet that John's going to be playing touch football in Central Park, and he's going to have his shirt off because he knows that'll get attention.
We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Gillen. Stephen is the author of the book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. It hasn't aired that. We're taping this on the 12th of July, and on the anniversary of his death, A&E is going to offer a documentary on that. And we see how close he was to his cousin Anthony.
That's right. I mean, John had a lot of challenges in that last year of his life. His marriage is in a bad place. The magazine is failing. But most of all, his best friend, the brother he never had, Anthony Roswell, is dying. John spent the last week of his life writing Anthony's eulogy. And John ended up dying before him. And that was a real difficult thing for John to deal with. He said to one of his friends, I don't know if I can deal with this. He said, I don't know if I could deal with Anthony dying.
Tell us a little bit. We have about a minute left in this interview. Steve, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us also a little bit about his relationship with Caroline. They were pretty close as well. It was a trio.
Caroline. Yeah, so John and Caroline had a very unique life. There's a lot of tension in that relationship also in the last couple of years. It had to do with their marriages. John was not a big fan of Ed, Caroline's husband, and they were not a big fan of Caroline. So they clashed over a couple of things. But the unfortunate thing is they never had time to work it out. They had such a close relationship and such mutual respect and affection for each other that they would have eventually worked it out. Unfortunately, I never had the opportunity.
And of course, as we end here, we want to say that the kind of guy John Jr. was you were facing a medical issue a week before he lost his life. And he said, Stevie, I'll take care of you.
He did. I was told that I may be in the early stages of ALS. I wasn't, but I didn't know that at the time. And John found out and he called me the next morning, the Saturday morning before he died. And he said, and said exactly that. He said, Stevie, I'll take care of you. And he repeated, he said, Stevie, I'll take care of you. And for me, that was what was so painful is here's a guy who's willing to move heaven and earth to take care of me. He told me not to worry about insurance. And then I wake up the following Saturday, almost exact time that he called, and find out his plane is missing. I'm helpless. I can't do anything for him.
Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Stephen Gillen. He is the author of the book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And joining us today is award-winning author Daniel Silva. Daniel is the best-selling author of 22 novels, including The Black Widow, House of Spies, and The Other Woman. He's best known for his long-running thriller series starring spy and art restorer Gabriel Alon. Silva's books are critically acclaimed bestsellers around the world and have translated into more than 30 languages. He lives in Florida with his wife, television journalist Jamie Gangle, and their twins, Lily and Nicholas. Now, before I continue, Daniel, I've always wondered about the correct pronunciation of Gabriel's last name.
Well, if you said it in Hebrew, it would be Alon, but I tend to anglicize it, and I just call him Alon.
Daniel's latest novel is The New Girl, and The New Girl takes place. It's an exclusive private school in Switzerland. Mystery surrounding, of course, from the very first page, the identity of the beautiful raven-haired girl who arrives each morning in a motorcade fit for a head of state. We'll leave it right there because Daniel's going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But first of all, Daniel, tell us a little bit about you growing up. Were you always interested in reading and doing research?
Well, I wasn't interested in doing research when I was a kid, but I was a big reader and was fortunate enough to get the idea early on that I wanted to be a writer. And I decided to become a journalist in order to become a writer. All of my heroes, my literary heroes, were journalists first, like Hemingway and Graham Greene and others. And so I became a journalist. And when I was 33, I started writing my first novel. And I was fortunate enough to get that book published.
Some of the books that we, I don't want to say forced, but yes, I am going to say forced, reading in high school English, or even junior high, some of those books, at that age, we're like, I'm not sure if I like this book.
No, I never had that feeling.
Ulysses.
I never had that feeling. No, I actually admitted in an interview with Entertainment Weekly this week that I have never read Ulysses. But I am not an English major, as a political science major. And that allowed me to take a lot of English in interdisciplinary stuff. And I love books. I love all books.
So I'm in the same category now. I like to read at least two books a week. That's because of my job as well. But I enjoy it. And what you just mentioned about studying journalism and political science, your books are very much, especially this one, The New Girl, is very much centered on some of the things that recently happened in the Middle East.
Sure. Yeah. All of my books are inspired by real world events in one degree or another. And this one, is much more closely in sync with what's going on in the real world. As I say in the foreword of the novel, that elements of the book are quite obviously inspired by the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist, and the rise and fall of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Begun a novel featuring a character like Mohammed bin Salman. I had written about 250 pages of that novel, and after Khashoggi's murder, I had to throw out all that work and start over because what I had written just was not in sync. It was too far out of step with how much things had changed in the post-Khashoggi world.
So did you have to start from scratch?
I had a couple little paragraphs here and there that I was able to keep, but everything else really had to go. It all fell by the wayside.
Well, as you mentioned, you do address that in your foreword, and sometimes people will not read the foreword or the prologue. I always do because it kind of sets everything up, and you do mention that. But when you continue with your story, what about the situation like we have now with talks about Putin, talks about decisions. You know, when Khashoggi was murdered, a lot of people were saying that we should have taken stronger action against the Saudi prince. But as you mentioned in some of your other interviews, that Saudi Arabia is very important to be in a good relation with the United States.
Well, what I also said was that in a perfect world, we would tell the Saudis to find someone else to be their next king.
Exactly.
File criminal charges against those responsible. I mean, Jamal Khashoggi was a U.S. resident, a U.S. person employed by an American newspaper. So I think that we should have held those responsible, criminally responsible. We should have pressed for their extradition, but that was never going to happen. If we survived 9/11 with the relationship, and we're going to survive this as well for a few more years, I would say. We just have too much at stake in the region. The economic ties are too deep. The military ties are too deep. I'm afraid that we've got to continue with this relationship. But it's still, we can't lose sight of the opportunity that he represents. And I think that I wish that we had punished him severely, that we had held him personally responsible and punished him severely. That's not going to happen, clearly. And so now we've got to remain engaged with Saudi Arabia and help him become the leader that he promised to be. And that is ultimately what this novel is about. Because if we can help him become the reformer that he wants to be, the possibilities are really extraordinary for the future of the Middle East.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Daniel Silva. His latest novel is The New Girl. Without giving away too much of the story, because there's just so much in there that you're tempted to maybe tell a friend, you need to read this because. But there's a hint there about some of Russia's influence in the Middle East as well.
Yeah. Look, Russia, during the Cold War, was a player in the Middle East. It had two important client states, Egypt and Syria. And with the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia's role in the Middle East really declined. And the civil war in Syria gave Russia a chance to get back in the game. We sort of dared Putin to intervene in Syria, and he said, oh, okay, I'll do that. And he came in Syria in a big way, helped the Assad regime prevail in the Syrian civil war. Helped Assad remain in power. And look, the region stood up and took notice of that. And now Russia is a growing power in the region. There's just no question about it. You know, Egypt's el-Sisi, President el-Sisi, has been to Moscow four times. He has not been to the United States four times. Even Benjamin Netanyahu has been to Russia to see Putin four times. There's just no doubt that Russia is vying for power and influence in the Middle East. And they also have a very close relationship with the Iranians, and that makes them in an enviable position that they're on both sides now of the Arab-Persian divide.
Which I guess it also poses a new question and perhaps even a new idea for you about how now that Russia does have an interest also, not now, but they've always had an interest with Iran, and now what's going on with our current administration and Iran, that could cause, that'd be like a keg of powder ready to explode.
You know, I've written about it a little bit, but it they can play a positive role if they want to. And I think that's one of the reasons why Mohammed bin Salman has forged a relationship with Vladimir Putin, is that it does give him a conduit to speak to the Iranians and to try to control tensions a little bit.
One of the people who I've interviewed before for the book club, and it's been a couple years now, but Nelson DeMille, and I thought it was interesting that he still writes a lot of stuff longhand on paper, something that I do when I'm writing.
Yeah, we have that in common, he and I.
Yeah. Oh, so you still do that?
I do, yeah. I write in longhand, and I know Nelson does as well.
So how does that help you?
I don't write the entire book in longhand, but I every important passage in the book is written in longhand. I start my day in longhand and sort of migrate to the computer. I obviously don't turn my book in longhand. I write in Microsoft Word, but I prefer to write in longhand. And I think that you'd be surprised at how many older writers, I consider myself at 58 to be sort of a bit of an older writer. How many of us actually do?
Wow, well, you're catching up with me. I'm 62.
Okay.
Okay, but I still write longhand.
I think the way it works is you'll always be a little bit older than me. I don't know that I'll catch up to you. Everything that I produce, be it on paper or digitally. But look, Facebook and Twitter, 140 characters, my goodness. It's changing the way people write, think, behave. We're only beginning to understand the behavioral and societal changes that social media are bringing about. I use social media professionally to communicate with my readership, but it really plays no role in my daily life. And the computer that I write on is not connected to the internet. And my phones and iPads are in a completely different room. I have no intrusion when I'm in my world, my fictional world. I keep the real world at bay.
Daniel, thank you so much for being with us here today. We appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. What a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We've been visiting with award-winning author Daniel Silva. His latest book is The New Girl.